I'll have more to add later. Next week, for sure.
Okay, LaChance. This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. On this week's episode, in St. John the Baptist Parish, a judge denied a request for a temporary injunction allowing a council vote to proceed on rezoning that would pave the way for Greenfield, Louisiana to construct its proposed grain elevator there. The beleaguered Sewerage and Water Board of New Orleans has no shortage of critics or suggestions for improvements. And now Governor Jeff Landry has weighed in with a report from a 14-member task force. And a group of non-tenured faculty at Tulane University have begun exploring efforts to unionize, joining a growing trend in higher education. Those stories, insight, and analysis coming up on Behind the Lens. Joining us this week, environmental reporter Delaney Dreyfus. Hey, Delaney.
Hello.
Photojournalist LaChance Perry. Hi, LaChance.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. And co-editor of The Lens, Katie Rechtall. Hey, Katie.
Hey, Carolyn.
So, Delaney, let's start first with you. I think you have an update for us. The Descendants Project, a nonprofit organization, lost its most recent court battle to try to stop the council in St. John the Baptist Parish from rezoning Land Wallace from residential to heavy industrial. They had asked for a temporary injunction. The court denied them. And then last night they had a vote. What happened?
Yes, so last night the parish council had a meeting where they voted to approve the rezoning for the Greenfield property in Wallace. The temporary restraining order request, there's a debate over what the judge actually said during that. Greenfield said that Judge Snowdy ruled that their request lacked merit. Whereas the Descendants Projects came back and said that the judge did not rule on the merit of their request at all. Essentially, the judge said that they came in too early. The judge wanted to allow the parish council to have this vote. And so now we will likely see the Descendants Projects come back with more litigation.
Okay, so sort of like refiling the request for the injunction, essentially.
Yes, the request for the injunction was too early, is essentially what the courts were saying. They needed to come back after the parish actually voted to approve the rezoning.
Hmm. Okay, so none of us being lawyers, but with that caveat in mind, is there any insight in this group as to whether this request will see a more favorable response now that council has voted indeed to change that, withdrawing the two? We should actually review of what this rezoning entailed and what the request was about, because it was about that they were violating this 2,000-foot rule and using a math that would pretty much decimate that entire rule in the whole parish, allowing lots of other development to happen. Can you review?
Yes, so there is a question over what boundary is required between this newly industrial site and the residential area of Wallace, which is a historically Black community, has been around since Union soldiers came back and bought land in the area to create a community. And also very interestingly, the Army Corps of Engineers updated one of their Section 106 review of this area, and they have come back and said that essentially there is a question over how the math is being done to determine the density of the community of Wallace. The consultant that has been hired by the parish or by Greenfield, it's not quite clear who is paying them, but this consultant has come in and done math based on the census designated place, which is a much larger swath of land that includes parts of the river where obviously nobody lives.
Right.
And so Justin Cray, this urban planner, has come in. He was hired by the Descendants Project, and he is arguing that this should not be how the math is done, that we should be using instead the smaller area of Wallace, the boundaries that conform the boundaries that create the community itself. And in doing so, if we change the math, the denominator, change how we do this math, it is found to be dense enough to trigger a locational requirement so that any industrial presence has to be 2,000 feet away from the residential area. And so really this whole, this question has come down to whether the parish is going to uphold its 2,000 feet locational distance that it requires between heavy industrial and residential areas, or if they are going to use this other math that has been proposed that would allow Greenfield to build directly in the area of Wallace, but would also remove those protections from the rest of the parish. Because if we look at how the parish is, the density of all the other communities in the parish are calculated, that there wouldn't be an area that is dense enough to trigger that protection.
Right, right.
The Jemison math.
Okay, so that's the really key issue here, is whether the judge sees that this requires some more study before allowing this to proceed. And after now the council having done this vote last night, seems like it would trigger the attention, at least from the judge, to entertain the idea.
Yes, that is a possible next step. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Okay. All right. Because we reviewed this so much last podcast, I think we can move on.
I think we have more to come on that ... you know.
Right. So. Right. Okay. There's a new report from a 14-member task force, which was assigned by Governor Jeff Landry to address chronic problems with the management of the Sewerage and Water Board of New Orleans. And it suggests several key changes. What are some of the things that this task force suggested happen?
Yeah, so one of the big controversial recommendations was a state-led takeover for a two-year period to have state chosen people determine the next steps for the New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board. And part of that suggestion comes from the task force idea that the Sewerage and Water Board needs to become the Sewerage, Water, and Drainage Board. There needs to be a consolidation of those duties, because currently the Sewerage and Water Board is handling some pipes, whereas the Department of Public Works is handling other pipes, and that has led to a lot of inefficiencies. So the chair of this task force, Paul Rainwater, has come forward to say that the state-led takeover was really more of a threat. He really wanted to push local politicians to act swiftly on these chronic problems. So there have been a few other suggestions. One, Rep. Alonzo Knox in New Orleans came in to introduce a bill to create a slightly different transitional panel. But that does not seem to have much support. So there are pushes from other state politicians to try and figure out a way to overhaul the Sewerage and Water Board to make sure that it is actually serving the community and that we have drainage in this city.
Which, you look out your window right now and you can see why. It's a chronic problem.
There are a number of grassroots organizations throughout the city who have been doing a lot of research for this work for a very long time. Some of them are not even grassroots. The Bureau of Governmental Research has been talking about this, looking into this issue for decades. They first recommended a stormwater management fee at least a decade ago. And now we have the Water Collaborative and the Water Justice Fund, or the Water Collaborative and Water Justice New Orleans, have put out the Water Justice Fund, which is a recommendation for how to best change this oversight. It's a group of locals who are looking at what the research is leading to for best recommendations to change the disproportionate burden that has been placed on locals, on residents and small businesses for paying for all of these infrastructure improvements. So they have put forth a set of suggestions, including a stormwater management fee and a number of restructuring possibilities in order to make sure that tax-exempt properties, these free water properties, are paying more so that we can actually change our infrastructure and make have a city that is capable of handling the rain that we now get all the time.
Right. Katie, can I ask a little bit of a bird's eye view from you to let me just suggest something and you can tell me if this rings true at all. That is this another example of you know, I'm thinking of consent decrees. I'm thinking of other times when a larger entity like the state or even the federal government comes in and says, you know, you guys there in New Orleans aren't doing it right. And let us fix it, or let us guide you in fixing it, or oversee you as you're fixing it. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think that rainwater actually served as an interim chief or director or something back after a flood. Mitch Landrieu appointed him to lead something in 2013 or something like that. So I think that people in New Orleans have sort of thrown up their hands in a certain sense about, I mean, if the state can come in and actually change something to a certain extent, I'm not sure that many people would have a problem with it.
Right.
The issue, I think, is that the Sewage and Water Board traditionally has been the cash cow. It's been the bag man of city government. So these contracts that flow from the Sewage and Water Board, literally, those contracts are worth a lot of money, and they are used, have been traditionally used as political patronage, as it's been explained to me. So the worry about the state stepping in without any sort of boots on the ground kind of roll up your sleeves sort of initiative makes some people wonder whether it's a cash grab. And I think that's the concern.
Okay. And I also read in the story that privatization is an option that's been floated by this task force. I can't imagine that would be very
interesting option. I think there was more of a fear that the task force would recommend privatization, whereas the task force actually recommended a secret third option that is similar to what they do right now in Louisville. And it is privatizing the Sewerage and Water Board, but making the city of New Orleans the sole stockholder. So that's a recommendation to create something called the New Orleans Water Company. It would be quasi-municipal like it is at the Louisville Water Company in Kentucky.
Okay. And on this podcast, we've talked about smart meters before. Can you remind everybody what those are and where they fit into this proposal?
Yes. So smart meters are a suggestion that the Sewerage and Water Board is pushing hard to get rid of inaccurate billing. That right now, a lot of billing is determined by estimates. And their argument is that if we have these fancy water meters that are determining to the last drop how much water you consume, that your bills are going to be more accurate. And something that the Water Collaborative has brought forward is a fear that those smart meters might be accurate to a fault. Like they might also take into account how much water is leaking from the pipes. And we know that leaky pipes are an issue throughout the city, and they don't want to see residents or local businesses being charged for those leaky pipes. So they have said, they've asked the Sewerage and Water Board if they are going to come in and install all of these smart meters, that they also work to identify where the leaks are and to replace those pipes.
Okay. Okay, Delaney, thank you. On a day that it's right in the face of New Orleans residents and everybody in Southeast Louisiana right now, how important those pipes are when we've got flooding in the streets and the threat of a big hurricane season coming. So thank you for that story.
Thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens. I'm Carolyn Heldman. My guests this week are environmental reporter Delaney Dreyfus, photojournalist LaChance Perry, and co-editor Katie Rechtall.
Hi, I'm Ann Muller, Chief Operating Officer at The Lens. At The Lens, our mission is to educate, engage, and empower readers with information and analysis necessary for them to advocate for a more transparent and just governance that is accountable to the public. That means our stories are deeply reported and can take months to find the truth. As an advocate for openness, we provide readers with the source documents used in our reporting, inviting them to check and challenge our work, or to build on it through their own research. Support us in this mission by becoming a subscriber to our newsletter. You will hear about our stories first, learn about upcoming events, and we promise to not inundate you with emails. Sign up today at thelensnola.org/newsletter. Thank you.
All right, Katie, what's going on over at Tulane? There's a unionization effort underway. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the big green is rabble rousing. What's happening? So, hard to say what's really happening. It's, such when you walk around a campus. I was out there the other day. I didn't really feel the restlessness of union organizing. It's not discernible yet on campus, but apparently there will be an election coming up probably in early May. We'll just see. I haven't heard yet anything about the election.
So this is non-tenured faculty. Is it also administrative staff?
It's very specifically non-tenured track faculty. People who are full-time non-tenured track faculty. There's people who are who are tenured professors and who have a much different tier of pay and benefits and respectability. And then there are a lot of instructors who are hired and are basically working full-time hours, but don't have the same kind of permanent job or benefits or level of pay that the others do.
Okay. Do you know how the effort to unionize took root? How did it start?
I guess it started sort of, there were a lot of little, almost like when you hear about a forest fire and there are like five different spark points, right? That's sort of what happened. There were a bunch of people who were sort of separately interested and they all started hearing about each other and they came together. That's sort of, as I understand it, the origin story.
And there are other higher education organizations around the country that have unionized, that are doing this. So they have models.
There's a burst, apparently, of this. I think what we always hear is sort of like the people who are not tenured track professors are expected to work a certain amount of hours and they don't get the same kind of benefits. There's the Tulane people described a wide disparity in pay across campus. And so I think you may be a non-tenure track professor or, considered a professor by your students, but you may not have the same kind of benefits that another professor across the hallway gets.
So you wrote that they wrote a letter to the president and suggested that this is underfoot, this is happening, and didn't get engaged by the president of the university.
Right.
The university, as far as last time I checked, the university isn't ready to make any statements. They're still studying it. So that's the apparently the protocol where you send us, you announce yourself to administrators and they can voluntarily recognize you. I'm told that recently there was a college, and it sounds like it maybe was Occidental, which is near LA, that had voluntarily recognized its union. I haven't found any proof of that in the news, so I'm not sure if that happened or not, but that's what I had heard. Trying to see if there was anybody who would actually voluntarily recognize unions. I think commonly it goes like this. You send a letter, they don't recognize you, and then you have to move to an election.
Okay.
This right now, the National Labor Relations Board is supposed to reach out to both Tulane and the union, which is workers, Tulane Workers United is called. And so they have to reach out to both the union and the administration and set a date.
Okay, so interesting that if they're successful, I wonder if that then spreads both to other universities all around. It's a pretty high profile university, Tulane, and you'd think that that would make pretty big waves. Also, though, on campus and at the school, if there would be any other efforts for other workers there, not faculty, but, cafeteria and housekeeping, all the other service providers at a school.
Right. Apparently that is how that usually happens. There's a whole bunch of tier of workers. And apparently this is, I don't know unionizing well enough to know, but I'm told that this is how this works, that you have a tiny group like this, or not a tiny group, that, this is 300 or some, maybe a little bit more than that, people, that this is how it's done, that you organize this group, and then other groups start doing it too, if they see the benefit of it. It is interesting. And I think that that's one of when I was looking at what's happening in higher ed, where there is a burst of unions, one of the issues is trying to unite those unions so that they're not so fractured, because this is such a tiny part of the overall Tulane staff, right? So trying to actually have everybody in the same union, or at least group, would be somewhat helpful, it seems. And that's apparently, there are some efforts to do that nationally.
That's so interesting. So, yeah. I like the way you framed it, that there was this energy and a vibe on campus, but it wasn't the students.
Among those who are unionizing, there's a sense of sort of excitement about, I guess, it's interesting because there's sort of a sense of potential that this could be really great for the university to have staff feel like they're more part of their scene, in a different way.
Yeah, having some power, some agency in their own. Yeah.
So we'll see. I don't know how Tulane will respond, if they will or not, but so far it's been pretty quiet from President Fitz's office.
Well, on the one hand, you think about a higher ed institution and an openness and a liberal viewpoint to the world, you'd think that maybe if it is Occidental that just recognized the union, maybe that's a domino that falls, that this is it's not like it's Amazon. It's
right.
It's an institution for higher learning. And you would think if anyone has the values of workers' rights, it would be a school like that.
Yeah, you're right. And I think there's two other things that are probably worth noting. One is that this is the first, there have, of course, there are no unions in Louisiana that are at public universities because of the way we're, you know, the way the state is structured publicly. But this is the first higher ed union in the state of Louisiana, to my understanding. Hmm. So they are expecting that there might be interest in other private institutions here. And also, some of the people who are leading the efforts have asked the university to remain neutral during the elections. Hmm. So, I mean, so far it seems like maybe they are. I don't know. Hmm. If they're just being quiet, I guess that is neutral. I don't know.
Right. Katie, did you break the story?
Yeah. I haven't even seen break. Hell, I think we're the only, I think we own the story right now. Nobody else has even written about it.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, good on you. Thank you. All right, you guys. I hope you stay warm and dry and get through this one.
Sounds good. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. The Lens aims to provide the information and analysis necessary to advocate for more accountable and just governance. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guest this week, environmental reporter Delaney Dreyfus, photojournalist LaChance Perry, and co-editor Katie Rechtall. You can read all the week's other news plus opinions at our website, thelensnola.org. Thanks for listening.